Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be jumping into the news in just a moment with Adam Boileau, and Sherrod DiGrippo is also joining us this week to talk through a few stories, and then we'll be hearing from this week's sponsor, which is Airlock Digital. They make application control or allow listing software. They are moving away from the term whitelisting. But their agent does a lot of other cool stuff too, like host hardening. They're a small but growing company based here in Australia. And I consider them to be the artisanal, unbleached, stone-baked sourdough of endpoint security. The endpoint security of connoisseurs, if you will. Airlock's David Cottingham will join the show this week to talk through some new stuff they've baked into their product, as well as to give us an update on what's on their roadmap. It's time to jump into the allow list pool, everyone. The water is warm. Come on in. But yes, it is news time now. Adam Boileau of Insomnia Security is here as always, and so is Sherrod DiGrippo, the Senior Director of Threat Research at Proofpoint. A full disclaimer here, Proofpoint is a show sponsor, but Sherrod appearing here with us now is not connected to that sponsorship in any way, shape, or form. And welcome to you both. Now, the first thing we're going to talk about this week is NSA and FBI doxing some GRU malware. God, I love 2020. Specifically, they doxed some like a Linux malware toolkit. There's some pretty fun angles here, but let me start off with you, Adam. What did you make of? I mean, you know, you're Linux guy, right? Out of the three of us, what did you think of the NSA document that they released?
Honestly, it's a beautiful thing. Like, it really warms my heart to see, you know, this kind of really old school technique of trad Linux rootkits, kernel mode Linux rootkits with all the classic bells and whistles, you know, written finest Russian, you know, tank grade engineering. It's just a beautiful thing. And the NSA's documentation of it is honestly probably better than what the Russians have, like really in depth. Great job reversing it, well written up. I really enjoyed it. Like, I'm jelly. I want a copy of this so that I can use it too, because it looks like a nice piece of tooling. And, you know, 20 years ago me really would have liked this. Like, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I kept having flashbacks to talks from like KiwiCon circa 10 years ago, like your talks and like Finbar as well. And yeah, it was just that sort of vibe.
It's such classic, beautiful technique.
Sherrod, is there enough useful stuff in this thing that, you know, someone like yourself who actually works in a role that's where you take this sort of information and try to make it actionable? Like, was this a useful document, or do you get the impression that it's just nya, 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 a bit of a middle finger aimed at Russia?
No, so I think it is useful. We love an attribution from a law enforcement agency. For state-sponsored, you just can't beat it, because what it allows us to do is we can kind of correlate now, and you can, at the very least, put a little bit to rest an attribution and say, look, if there's an indictment, if there's a press release, if the NSA and the FBI say that it's this group, in the intel community, we're all just going to kind of agree that this is the group that it is. And you can get away from the hundreds of different names and all of
the So hang on. What you're saying is the primary benefit here is you get to settle all of the clustering arguments that happen in threat researcher slacks.
Exactly. And I think you and I have talked a little bit about what a mess that is with people like Joe Slowick. It's crazy how difficult that is. And the main reason for that is that everybody that does intelligence has access to a different source of data. And so, you know, you can kind of look at the FBI and the NSA and say, okay, they have access to all the data, the best data, maybe data they shouldn't even have access to. And that kind of gives us a little bit of a reprieve, and we can say, okay, they're probably right. Let's move forward from here. The indicators are usually good when they come out in these kinds of releases. But I wanted to ask Adam, you were kind of saying, I wish I had this. So what do you think the chances are that this will be potentially spread around, or that somebody could create something similar?
Well, I mean, you know, it's using tricks that have been used by the hacker scene for a very long time. I mean, this kind of kernel mode rootkit is pretty old school. What's nice is having one that's, you know, supportive on modern kernels, for example, because that's one of the things that was always really fiddly about maintaining this kind of tooling, was you had to have kernel modules that were built against all the versions of Linux you were going to run up against. And that's the sort of thing that, as a bedroom hacker, you can do for a few Red Hats or a few SUSEs or Debians or whatever. But doing it against a bunch of stuff, like, that takes actual work. So, you know, getting hold of something like this, you know, that's weaponized and usable in the real world and has workable, you know, malleable C2 channels, that kind of thing is, I mean, in this case, I think it's just like JSON over WebSockets or over HTTP anyway. But, you know, having something that's actually been used versus just kind of homebrew, there is quite a bit of gap in it. You know, that last 80% of making a tool really genuinely useful is boring, right? It's not fun work. So that's why I want it, right? Just for the maintenance burden. And I guess they, you know, the GRU aren't really selling support contracts. So, you know, that's a bit of a challenge.
I mean, that could be a pivot at some point. You never know. But I found a couple of things interesting here. One is that, you know, you just mentioned that the C2 is handled by JSON over HTTP. The US government's released a bunch of YARA rules that help you detect the message format that the C2 uses. So rather than looking at destination addresses, it's actually looking at message format. Of course, they can change the message format, but that was an interesting thing to do, I thought. The other thing is, both of you have spoken about getting your hands on this thing. No one has seen it. I've even been asking around saying, you know, who's got a sample? Because a couple of people I know want one. No one's got it, which tells me that it may not really be out there in the wild that much, which begs the question, where the hell did NSA get it from? And I don't think they got it rolling incident response. Let's just put it that way. It looks like they have gone right into these GRU operators' infrastructure and just pulled it straight from there. Like this really does look like there's a bit of a psychological operation angle to this, as in like, we are all up in your sh-.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's true, but I do think that, you know, there's not a lot of EDR tools for Linux. It's a pretty attractive platform in terms of, Windows absolutely dominates anything having to do with AV or detection or any of that stuff. So Linux is a pretty cool thing to have. Carbonac's a great example of like a sophisticated actor that would just burn through Windows machines, get caught sometimes, but keep their persistence on Linux in the past because they could keep a foothold there and nobody would find them when they were absolutely kicking them out of the network on Windows. So.
Well, you've just raised a good point because this thing is actually pretty hard to detect, right? Like it's, you can't.
Well, nobody's doing detection on Linux. I mean, it's there. And the Red Hat review of it kind of gives some details, but I don't know of a ton. It's very edge case to have people doing lots of endpoint detection on Linux.
Yeah.
Even though it is year of Linux on the desktop every year.
So, Adam, what do you think? Do you think this was some NSA op going deep into enemy cyber territory to retrieve this thing, or do you think it might have popped up in the wild somewhere? It's impossible to know.
Well, when you see write-ups like this, right, you see a really good description of the stuff that's running on the edge, like where the actual compromise is happening. In this case, we also see like details of how the middle boxes are configured, like how the database works and how the client works, which very much says we are not just rolling incident response here. We are way up in your business, looking at how it's all configured all the way back, and specifically talking about like how the agent to the C2 middle works, like how the comms works for that. Like that says we are in the middle of your stuff, it's pretty clear. So yeah, I do think there is definitely a degree of fairly stern middle finger going on.
I love that their advice, the government's advice on this is, look, if you don't want to get stung by this, just roll, universal UEFI like kernel extension signing.
And it's actionable.
Like, yeah, mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. I'll just knock that out on Tuesday, right? Like it's I mean, it's good advice, but it's not exactly usable advice. Anyway, let's move on to the next story now while we've got Sherrod here. Sherrod, you are our Emotet enthusiast. Tell us about this story. This is actually quite funny. Someone actually managed to essentially subvert Emotet by... You talk us through it. You're going to explain it better than me.
Sure. So I absolutely am an Emotet enthusiast for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that I'm responsible for detection at work, and Emotet, oh man, it's tough. They're really good at evasion. And Quinn from Binary Defense, along with Team Cymry and James Shank, both of whom are friends of mine, shouts and greets, old school style to them, to Cryptolamus. He was able to find where the persistence was being kept within the registry. So that's when the machine power cycles, essentially, how Emotet was maintaining its ability to stay on that machine. And James basically found that if you go in there and you make some changes to those registry entries, it will cause a buffer overflow. So he was able to get together with some other researchers, distribute that through the certs, and for about 6 months, I think they were able to understand, how they could kind of keep Emotet off a machine, especially if it power cycled. That's something that's really probably not going to work at scale. A lot of enterprise is not going to say, hey, let's run this PowerShell script to protect everybody from Emotet. However, it's an excellent point of research to be able to know that that works. The Emotet gang, Emotet keeps changing. It keeps evolving. It keeps getting better. It keeps finding out if it's being detected. Everybody that does this research has a team that watches it change all day long. It watches Emotet find out how we're detecting it. Emotet makes the changes. We have to make the changes. And so James Quinn was able to find a way that it could sort of defeat that persistence. It's a bug in the malware, and that's a pretty cool thing to find.
Now, here's the story that actually wound up leading our newsletter this week. The SANS Institute actually managed to get one of its employees managed to get their inbox owned by a malicious like Azure OAuth app, right? So in the newsletter this week, Brett wrote it up as like, hey, you know, everyone's talking about this GRU Linux malware. It's very sexy. It's very cool. But like while you're talking about GRU malware, you're getting owned by this dumb Microsoft thing where they're charging you megabucks for the tools you need to actually mitigate what is essentially shitty design. And I think that is an excellent point. I mean, what hope do we have? What hope do organizations have of protecting users against these OAuth-based attacks when even people who train blue teamers, an organization that trains blue teamers, gets hosed this way?
I mean, it's a pretty solid point, right? You would expect SANS to have their stuff together, and you know, this kind of OAuth phishing, people are not used to spotting it. It's really effective. You know, we use it on engagements because it works well, and it gets you where you need to go. So, you know, Brett's take in the front of the newsletter, I was totally on board with him. And you know, Linux kernel rootkits, like that's my jam. But if I want to shell someone these days, this is how I'm going to do it, not with, you know, kernel mode.
There was a little bit of an inaccuracy in the newsletter. We said that you need E5 to be able to get access to like the Microsoft Cloud security tools or whatever, MCAS. That's not actually true. You can get it as a standalone. I mean, it's still like quite expensive. You can get it as part of E5 as well. It's like basically even the person who pointed out that we got it wrong was at pains to tell us it wasn't our fault given how confusing Microsoft licensing tranches are. But I don't think it, look, even if we got some of the details around the actual precise licensing tiers and costs, I think the broader point still stands, which is if you're going to make software that lets your users get owned this way, you got to be able to give them the tools. Like MCAS lets you set policies around what type of apps can be installed, permissions and also approval flows and things like that. That should be bog stock standard. Sharon, I wanted to ask you about this because I know that Proofpoint, where you work, and I've spoken to you about this, I've spoken to other people at Proofpoint about this. The number of like rogue malicious Azure apps doing the rounds right now is just out of control.
It's crazy. You can make one super easily and there's no checks really on them. And then the way that you did is in the SANS attack where you send an email essentially saying something's been shared with you via O365, click here, install the app. And it's the same way as an app on a mobile device. It says, you know, does it have permission to read your contacts, look at your email, create email rules, and access all of these different things. Once you say yes, it is in. And the thing to remember here too is that after you've authorized this app, multi-factor authentication is done. You only have to authorize it once. So this is a good way that people can really, really get into somebody's O365. And I think that people sometimes don't understand that this isn't just getting into someone's email to read their email. It is assuming their corporate identity. You are becoming that person. You can send email as them. You can upload files as them. You can look at every file they've ever uploaded. You can chat as them. You're essentially logged in as that user, and you have a lot of power.
Well, and one of the things that makes it such a nice attack is that, you know, the user is authenticating to Microsoft when they're authorizing this app. It's not some shady login page somewhere else, is it?
They're essentially telling Microsoft to allow this app into their account.
Yeah, yeah. So we had an email from a user. I'm not going to name him because we didn't ask him, but he says that using MS Graph, you can query all apps that users consented to as well as which permissions were granted. Any app that requests mail.read or files.read and is consented to by a user should raise suspicion. Look, fair enough, right? And he wrote a PowerShell script that lets him do that. But Microsoft should be providing these tools, right?
Why? Why is Microsoft putting people through this? That's something that I don't understand. And then further, a lot of these are hosted on domains that are absolute typo squatting of Microsoft trademark brands and products, like Microsoft with a zero.
Well, we saw the big thing that, you know, when Australia released those really bad threat intel, was that like a month or two ago? That all pertained to a malicious Azure app that was designed to look like a very popular email security and filtering company here in Australia.
Yeah, it's really easy to register these domains, and Microsoft does no checking for them. So you could host one of these malicious third-party apps on like microsoftonlineapps.com or whatever you want to register, and Microsoft does no checking, even for their own trademarks.
Adam, you know, OAuth apps, rogue OAuth apps, I think, are something we've been talking about on the show for years, but it feels like, particularly this year, it's, you know, it's an attack class that is here, it is present, and it is being ramped up big time. Do you think it's sustainable for Microsoft to keep charging for the solution to this? Or do you think maybe what regulators are going to get involved, or pressure from customers is going to resolve this? Like, what's your feeling on where this is headed? Because I personally feel like this is going to get a lot worse before it gets better, and eventually the pressure is going to become too much for them and they'll have to do something.
I mean, you know, Microsoft's in the process of reinventing how the bulk of people who do office work go about their business, right? And this is the chance that they have to make up for, you know, LM hashes and NT hashes and Windows domains and their screwed up Kerberos and all of the other things that we have to live with for 20
years. But it's also their chance to do the same sort of thing again.
Well, I mean, yes, but I'm hoping that, you know, if they look at themselves, maybe they would think that they have a chance to just not lump us with 20 years of things that we're going to be living with again, you know, but maybe I'm being optimistic for a change.
That's very unusual for you.
It is.
Moving on, look, just really quickly, this is just one that I'm going to link to from the show notes. The US Army has released a report that says many North Korean hackers are operating from abroad. That's something we already knew. We've seen examples of attackers, you know, working for North Korea, being based in places like Malaysia and whatnot. But the scale of it is pretty interesting. They say they have at least 6,000 hackers and electronic warfare specialists working in its ranks. That report.
Not just hackers, cyberspace hackers, according to the US Army.
Cyberspace hackers are the worst, absolutely worst. And then we got one more story that we're going to just mention quickly while Sherrod's here, which is Oracle is apparently... And look, this is just like rumor reports, but apparently Oracle is looking at buying TikTok. And Sherrod, you are our resident TikTok fan. You like to post TikToks with you and your beloved dog.
What are your
feelings? I mean, would you be super happy to be using Oracle TikTok?
Oh my God. Everyone just needs to stop. Poor TikTok. So yes, I unabashedly love TikTok. I think that it's wonderful, and I've perfectly trained my TikTok algorithm on my For You page to only show me dog videos. So you think that it's tough to submit a bug report to Microsoft? You think Microsoft's tough with security? Try Oracle.
They just reply with a standard. They've got a standard form letter, which is basically a lawsuit.
Yeah.
So you try to report a bug, and they say, "We're taking you to court."
Yeah, and then I also wonder, you know, there's some kind of relationship between Larry Ellison and Trump. Trump hates TikTok. Is it some kind of, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch mine with that? But here's the thing: if Microsoft drops out, if they do it at the last second, then the deadline for being acquired for TikTok passes, and they just can't operate in the USA. And every second that they can't operate, they lose money and their valuation drops. So it's a lose-lose for TikTok. They've been politically punched into a corner.
They absolutely have. And like, I mean, it's the whole thing is so wild. I'm going to resist the temptation to really get bogged down in it too much. But yeah, you essentially have the president of the United States holding a gun to ByteDance's head saying, you have to sell this asset and quick. And now it looks like there's some interest from a company that he's quite close to. I mean, the whole thing just smells a little bit bad. That's not to say that action shouldn't be taken against Chinese apps that are gaining a lot of traction in the United States. It's a legitimate issue, right? We've spoken about it on the show before, but like, it's just amazing that like, we got a guy in the United States right now who, even when he's doing kind of the right thing, he does it the wrong way and it turns into the wrong thing somehow. It's just wild.
Yeah, Oracle's worth $166 billion. They have $43 billion on hand. They could buy it. but Oracle, weird. Yeah. I think you're going to lose a lot of cachet. Cottagecore TikTok, hashtag Cottagecore is done once we're on Oracle.
Oh, man. Well, look, Sherrod, thank you very much for joining us for this front part of the news to talk through those stories that were, you know, that was a tailor-made news selection for Sherrod DiGrippo to comment on. We really do appreciate it. We'll have you back on soon. And yeah, I think you're actually scheduled for a sponsor interview soon by coincidence. So, you know, we'll be talking to you again soon.
Talk to you guys again soon. Thanks so much. Thanks, Adam. Thanks, Patrick. Have a good one.
Bye.
See you, Sherrod.
Now, look, staying on the topic of Trump, which, you know, I know there's a select group of listeners out there who just love it when we talk about U.S. politics. the Senate intelligence report into Trump-Russia has landed. And, you know, I think a few people have been surprised at how much juicier it is compared to the Mueller report, Adam. And in particular, looking at contacts between, and the reason we're speaking about it is it's really looking at contacts between Paul Manafort and the hack and leak operation against the DNC. I mean, it's basically come out and said that, yeah, you know, Manafort probably had a hand in that.
Yeah, it does seem juicier than the previous ones. And like the tie-up between Manafort's, you know, kind of Ukrainian contacts and Russian intelligence is pretty clearly stated here, whereas before it was a bit sort of wishy-washy. But a direct tie between, you know, the personas presented by Russian intelligence that were, you know, doing the hack and leak stuff, you know, straight into the middle of the Trump campaign. Like, I don't know how much clearer they need it, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's interesting because as far as I can tell, this is a bipartisan thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, right. So, I mean, like, you know, what more do you want, America? Like, this, it seems pretty clear, you know?
It's funny, right? Bob Mueller didn't turn out to be as high energy as we were expecting, right? Now, look, staying on just, you know, the craziness that is the United States, Trump is considering pardoning Edward Snowden, right? Apparently. There have been news reports that he's considering pardoning Edward Snowden. And look, I actually had someone, a friend of ours actually, Adam, write to me, just message me and say, what's this all about? Can you help me with the politics here? And I'm like, well, this helps Trump sell the idea that the Democrats and the FBI spied on his campaign, and it's all like that's the politics here, right? This is all about smearing the Democrats, smearing the FBI, smearing the deep state. Edward Snowden was a brave deep state whistleblower. That's the idea. I mean, that's my read on this. What's yours?
And my read was, I was going to ask you why, because I don't understand. Yeah, I mean, that's as good an explanation as any, because I mean, nothing makes any sense anymore with this guy. Like, I don't know. I have no cogent analysis. This is just, I don't know anymore.
Yeah, so we'll see if it actually happens. I'm not sure that it will, because I'd imagine there would be a lot of people arguing against it, if I had to guess. We've got a piece here from Joe Cox at Motherboard. He's continuing his excellent reporting into this issue of law enforcement agencies in the United States buying access to people's personal data rather than acquiring it through a, you know, court-issued warrant process. This time, it's the Secret Service.
Yeah, and this is one of the things, like the reporting about this previously, you know, has been a little bit generic, and having some specific examples of government agencies buying access to this data is kind of what this story needs, obviously what he's been looking for. So this was a Secret Service buying a service called LocateX for a company called Babel Street that, you know, aggregates location data from a bunch of, you know, commercial mobile apps and things like that, as a good example of the sort of thing that they would otherwise have to warrant. So yeah, it's exactly what, you know, Joe's been looking for. To try and flesh out this particular story, I think.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how the US government might regulate this, because, you know, it's entirely possible that if you come down on this sort of practice too hard, you might like limit the ability of the FBI or whoever to, you know, go through like dumped user databases from Carter forums and stuff. And we want them doing that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a delicate balance to be kind of struck here. There's, you know, examples, like you said, of people, you know, handing them data from hacked forums and things, and they've made very good use, right? We've seen some really good arrests. We've seen, you know, good law enforcement follow-up from a number of, you know, those kinds of things. But on the other hand, it does seem a little bit weird for law enforcement and other agencies to be able to just go and buy wholesale access to marketing databases and you know, kind of use that instead. So I don't know where that balance is, but I mean, yeah, clearly it's not at either end.
It's hard, right? It's hard. It's not as straightforward as some people would like to think. Andy Greenberg has written this story up for Wired, which is a bit of a mixed bag. I got to be honest. We love your work, Andy, but this one was a bit funny because I've included it because it actually gets there in the end. But it sort of starts off by talking about how, you know, this terribly new social engineering threat targeting Twitter, has been targeting other companies, which is like, well, you know, social engineering's been out there for a while. I think, Adam, you pointed out in Slack earlier that this was literally a part of the movie Hackers, right? Like way back when was this type of social engineering. But the part of this story that I did find interesting is that there's a bit of speculation that some of these kids in Discord who are really good at social eng might wind up getting essentially contracted by ransomware crews to do very specific accent correct, social engineering over the phone. I thought that was a scary thought.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, hacking has kind of gotten more difficult compared to what it was, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And social engineering is much more kind of well understood, I think, you know, and easier to get into. And, you know, clearly, you know, you don't have to be an old graybeard to do this, right? I mean, the kids are really good at social engineering. They understand how to do it. And it makes sense given the commoditization of the, you know, cybercrime world that they would then pick up, you know, contracts to do individual social engineering gigs, much like, you know, we've seen money laundering sort of, you know, commoditized and, you know, other aspects of the crime tool set. So yeah, totally makes sense that would happen. And I, you know, because it works well and, you know, as you make technical controls better, attackers are going to look elsewhere. And, you know, this kind of social stuff is a logical place for large scale attacks to go. And, you know, the techniques are old, like from the movie Hackers, you know, from Mitnick and, you know, way back in the old days. But, you know, if it's effective, people are going to adopt it.
And, you know, they got access to tools these days that that the old guard didn't. Joe Cox, another one here from Joe Cox over at Motherboard, talking about, look, he's given it the headline, "The Secret Sims Used by Criminals to Spoof Any Number," and talking about these magical SIM cards that let you do caller ID spoofing and can even alter your voice and things like that. It turns out it's not the SIM that's the magic here. It is that people are basically running virtual telcos and you're getting a SIM that makes you a subscriber there, and then you're just like roaming onto everyone else's networks. That's basically what we're talking about here, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it, right? I mean, there's criminally operated MVNOs, the virtual network operators, running off somebody else's infrastructure, and then they're selling SIM cards, you know, that can be used via roaming from, you know, other places around the world, and then routing the calls back through the criminally controlled enterprise to allow services like, you know, call spoofing or, you know, accessing the network in funny ways, or, you know, voice altering as a kind of a comedy sort of thing. I don't know how well that works in the middle of the network.
Well, I was just thinking when we were talking about that last story, if you're going to take on the contract to do some social engineering, keep in mind you're leaving behind a very reliable biometric in the form of a recording of your voice. If you aren't actually taking adequate steps to disguise your voice, and that's hard. I know a little bit about audio, right? And if you're just like pitch shifting, that ain't going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is a thing that does tie you know, quite closely to the crime you're committing, much more so than a lot of online stuff. But yeah, I mean, people have been making creative use of the phone system, you know, for a very long time. And this is, you know, sort of a new approach to doing it, like convenient in the sense, you know, bung a SIM in your mobile and then set up a bit of, set up the APN on your phone and have everything just work. Like, that's pretty smart. But, you know, using that in ways that, you know, defeat investigation is still pretty difficult. And that's one of the things about, you know, selling these to the criminal world is that the sort of degree of protection that it gives you, I think, has been misrepresented by some of the vendors. Joe Cox talks through, you know, some of the promises made or the you know, marketing promises of these services, and they don't really live up to what's the technical reality.
I can see the FBI reading through the ad copy from these virtual telcos and nodding away, grinning maniacally like that Jack Nicholson gif, you know, like that's
and of course, like, how much experience does the spook world have at breaking into telcos? Quite a lot. And I would be, you know, like, a regular telco is hard enough to secure. A criminally operated MVNO on somebody else's rubbish infrastructure, you got no hope.
I mean, it'd be even easier than trying to own one of these over the top service providers, right, that were running some of these crime phones where it was all over the top and not even plugged into actual telco infrastructure.
Yeah, at least the over-the-top people, they've got a solid chance to be able to isolate their infrastructure, whereas, yeah, if you're running a telco, you're tied very firmly into, you know, an old telco world that's just never, you know, There's no malicious, like running a malicious telco is just not a thing that you're going to be able to do and get away with for very long.
It's so, funny. It's funny that you say they got a chance to do it right, because history shows us that they don't.
I mean, they could. The fact that they don't, yeah. You know.
I think it's better, you know, if you're a criminal listening to this show, you're going to just have to hide in the mainstream apps and take your chances that way. Because if you start rolling out to some of this niche stuff for serious crime, it ain't going to end well. Yeah. Moving on, the cruise operator Carnival has been hit by ransomware. So that's bad news if you were looking to book your, you know, COVID leper cruise. The Jack Daniels manufacturer was the target of a ransomware attack as well. That piece is written by Jordan Robertson of Bloomberg. He was one of the authors of the chips the size of a grain of rice super micro yarn. Interesting to see his byline back there. Mm-hmm. Covering information security stories. What else have we got? The Blackboard ransomware attack. This happened months ago, but it feels like what's going on is more and more organizations are discovering information about this breach and realizing it affected them. I didn't know how much of a big deal Blackboard was until very recently, Adam.
Yeah, this is an interesting case study of a service provider like this, you know, as a service vendor getting themselves ransomware and then what that means for downstream impact on their customers and the very long tail of that. Because Blackboard were providing, for example, services to, you know, a bunch of charities, for example, in the UK. And, you know, they're only just starting to figure out that the data has been, you know, accessed by somebody else. And the funny thing is the Blackboard apparently did pay the ransomware operator to delete the data. But of course, the downstream customers can't really rely on that. So yeah, it's a good example of how complicated this is for as a service vendors getting themselves owned.
A medical billing firm in the United States called R1RCM. They've apparently been ransomwared, and you know, that's a whole bag of fun for them. Krebs has that story. What else have we got? Canadian government online services were actually forced offline after credential stuffing attacks. That's a story by Jessica Howarth at Daily Swig.
Yeah, it looks like someone was cred stuffing against the central government authentication service, and they took the authentication offline to kind of stop the number of accounts being compromised. I think they said, well, something like 9,000 accounts ended up getting access just through, you know, through bad credentials of the, you know, 12 million or whatever people are registered for the service. So a small percentage, but when it's government services, you know, still a big deal.
This next piece I found very interesting. This is another one from Catalin at ZDNet. Ukraine has arrested a gang that was running 20 crypto exchanges and doing a bunch of money laundering. They were helping ransomware crews. They were even deploying some of their own ransomware. But the interesting part of this story is that apparently a big part of the reason these guys got pinched is because the cryptocurrency exchange Binance actually has an internal project to try to track down a lot of these shady exchanges and then, you know, work with the police to get these people arrested. And I think, hey, that's great, but I'd maybe watch out for the car bombs.
Well, yeah, exactly, right? I mean, it is good to see some of the Bitcoin operators and cryptocurrency operators in general, you know, taking the lead in this kind of thing, because they understand it's important for the reputation and functionality of their ecosystem.
I get that as well, but they put out a press release on this. And I'm just thinking, do you want ants with AK-47s? Yeah. Because this is how you get ants with AK-47s.
Yeah. Like, it doesn't seem entirely all the way thought through. I'm following with them for the first kind of 60, 70%. But, yeah, they're putting out the marketing release. Oh, it's just, yeah, that seems like a bad idea.
It would do this. But do it quietly.
Yes, do it quietly. Like, do it for the good of humanity, not for the goddamn press release.
I mean, it has got sketchy before. People forget. But things have got sketchy before for people doing things like this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's very real crims doing, you know, previously making very real money, and now you've locked up a bunch of them. There's going to be some salt, you know? And do it quietly. Shh.
Yeah. Yeah, keep it quiet, guys. What else have we got here? Signal. You know, we know eventually they're going to move to a handle-based system away from a phone number-based system, and we have commented on the show many times that there is going to be just a deluge of abuse. Signal has introduced a new feature, which is message requests, right? So they've done this ahead of the big change, and I'm guessing it's related to the change that's happening. But it's good to see them introduce these sort of anti-abuse features.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, and rolling this out earlier before they need it, get everyone used to it, you know, test it all, makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's one of the things with Signal, right? I mean, they are in the end smart cats, right? And you know, it's going to be a mess, but I think they seem to be doing, you know, heading in the right direction, other than you know, where the mess is going to be.
Now, we've got a report here that says researchers have figured out how to eavesdrop on 4G, like LTE calls, which is big news if it's true. But like with any story about like, we broke the crypto, you know, I used to have the saying like in the early 2000s, like everyone claims they've broken SSL. And then it turns out to be weird, some weird side channel thing that gets you like one byte of a key or something, you know. So is this the real deal or is this edge case weirdness?
So it's a little bit of both. I was dubious when I first read it, and then I read it again. It is actually legit. These researchers from Ruhr University in Germany, they have actually done some real work. So the attack they've come up with is the ability to recover the audio off a mobile phone on the leg from the handset to the cell site. And the way it works is that you, with a broadband radio receiver, you sniff the radio comms from a handset to the tower. And then as soon as they've hung up, you as the attacker place a call to the originating handset and then record that as well. And then in some instances, like some manufacturers have implemented
it doesn't rotate the key.
Short period of time, you end up with the same keystream.
Yeah.
So at that point, you've got the clear text traffic on your side, a ciphertext call off the wire. You can XOR out the key because it's just XOR with a keystream and recover the contents of the original call if you can do this in a short enough time window and the cell site in question reuses key material, which that's the real question is why on earth would any of the vendors have screwed up the implementation such that they would reuse key material, because that seems like a terrible idea. But yeah, it's much more real than from a crypto perspective than a lot of the other attacks you're thinking of. But in the real world, I mean, you've got to be physically close. You've got to rely on a cell tower being kind of crappy. They've got to answer the call. You've got to keep the call up long enough to get the keystream for the full duration of the call you want to decrypt. So, fiddly in real life. But the sort of thing a SIGINT agency would probably have already know about and already be doing.
Maybe. I mean, it doesn't seem that stealthy, but, they'd probably just roll right into the bloody tower and steal the shit from there, right?
I guess they've got other options. But in terms of like crypt analysis, like things that you would do if you were a SIGINT agency, this is the sort of thing that a bit more bread and butter for, trad SIGINTing rather than modern cybering.
Yeah. We spoke, I think it was last week or the week before, about how Mozilla's deal with Google was looking a bit shaky and probably not going to be renewed. It's changed. It looks like it's being renewed.
Yeah, it looks like Google signed on until 2023. So Mozilla's been thrown a bone for another couple of years to try and find some other way to make money.
Adam, we're not going to spend too much time talking about bugs, but this one I thought rates a mention.
Yeah, this is someone reported a bug in a JavaScript serialization library that serializes JavaScript objects down into JSON for transport to and from. Leads to code exec when you deserialize an arbitrary kind of crafted object. In the node world that we live in, I could see this being kind of important. Interesting bug if you do maintain JavaScript software, worth having a look at.
Adam, before we go, it is time, of course, for our skateboarding dog story of the week. This one I first saw on Twitter and I'm like, I know Catalin Kimpanu. I've got a sense for his for the sort of stories he likes to write. And I'm like, I bet you he writes this one up. He did. Walk us through it because it is glorious.
So if you have seen mail to links, like in a browser, you click on a link, it opens your mail client so that you can send an email to whoever you want. That, which was always a terrible idea. Apparently some implementations of this let you specify attachments in the mail to URL. So you can put like, mail to, bob@test.com. ?? And then provide a file off the local file system to attach to the email, which is just a terrible idea and no one should do it. I'm pretty sure even the RFC says maybe don't do this. Apparently some clients actually did support this and pleasantly. And the thing that made me laugh about the story is that the list of clients that support this is like so much ancient rubbish that no one has any business running anymore. Evolution on Linux on the desktop, KDE email on Linux on the desktop, Lotus Notes, which is now IBM Notes /HCL Notes, or Ancient Thunderbird. If you run any of those mail clients, don't worry about this bug. You have so many other problems in your world that, this doesn't matter.
Look, I love the examples they've used, like GPG keys, like SSH keys, password files, right? Like and that's the thing. I could have the contact form on risky.biz. You'd hit it to send a message and it would just attach that. Maybe autofill the subject as well. And boom, I've got your keys. How good.
And like all three people in the world who are vulnerable to this, you'll get their key material. But
there is someone out there, some absolute like Thunderbird fanboy or girl who's got it working with their GPG, who's just never upgrading to anything else. You know that person exists.
I mean, I do. I know some of those people. Some people are in my very office, but they better not do it on work machines. God damn it.
All right, mate. Well, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, it's been a lot of fun, and we'll do it all again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there of Insomnia Security in New Zealand. And don't forget, Insomnia offers top-tier security consulting services to clients all over the world, and you can find them at insomniasec.com. Thanks also to Sherrod DeGrippo of Proofpoint for popping in to the news segment as well. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with David Cottingham of Airlock Digital. Now, this is a company that regular listeners would know I really like. Their product has traditionally been described as whitelisting software. That is a term that we are all moving away from in this industry. They're doing that, but they're doing it carefully, because currently about 90% of the traffic to their website comes from people searching for that word, right? So but they're moving it. They're talking more in terms of application control, allow listing, safe listing, you know, other ways of describing it. But yeah, they set up their company really to deliver something nobody else really has. They've engineered allow listing software that is actually manageable at scale. That's the common pushback you hear against allow listing software. They say, oh, it doesn't scale. It does. They've got an install out there of 30,000 endpoints at the one customer, right? And they're not having any problems. This stuff also plays nicely with EDR. You can buy it in the CrowdStrike store. So if you are a CrowdStrike customer, I would recommend that you definitely trial this. You know, and one thing that their customers are finding too, the ones who already have EDR, is that it's a lot less work. Your EDR is a lot less work when there's nothing like alerting, because you're running an allow list, right? So that's something to keep in mind. They've also built some cool stuff into this that you're not really getting in from other, you know, endpoint security solutions. So they've got some host hardening stuff that just squashes all of the lol bins that people, attackers, would normally use to bypass things like EDR and allow listing software. Again, as you can tell, I am a fan. This isn't hideously bloated and trivially bypassable enterprise shitware, which sadly describes a lot of what's out there. This is software that a lot of practitioners really like. Oh, side note too, Big Pharma in the United States seems very, very interested in Airlock stuff right now. And, you know, their threat profile, Big Pharma's threat profile, has kind of changed this year. Obviously, they are really embracing this software. But more and more companies in the U.S. are starting to become interested too, because there are these incoming NIST certifications that mandate application control to get to a certain level. I think it's level 3. So that's the Cybersecurity Model Maturity Certification. To get to level 3, you need application control or allow listing software, and that's what Airlock does. Anyway, enough of my rambling. David Cottingham joined me for this interview, in which he updates us on some of the features in the latest release of Airlock Digital, and talks a bit about their roadmap and why building EDR features into their product isn't really a high priority for them right now. Here's David Cottingham.
So we've got a release coming with just enterprise, more enterprise type features. So,
more enterprise. You know, SAML, more enterprise.
Exactly. Yes, more one-click deployment. You know, we've got some SAML authentication. Linux agents can now survive through kernel updates, things that are really painful in the Linux system when you're doing updates. And also we're developing publisher style support for Linux. So you'll be able to basically trust sort of Linux update packages and have them automatically allowed to run. Something that, you know, before we started Airlock, we were having lots of trouble in the ecosystem managing application control style software.
Yeah, because those packages would expand and then it would be hard.
Yeah, exactly right. So, and also we're currently developing configuration auditing, which is something that we see as sort of the next, I guess for us, hot security fundamental.
I mean, look, you've been doing the sort of MITRE ATT&CK style endpoint hardening, right? Through your agent for a while, but now you've got it to the point where you can audit stuff outside of the control of your own agent. Walk us through that, because I think there's gonna be a bunch of people listening to this who are gonna find that pretty interesting. So, you know, you can, for example, spot where group policy isn't sticking. And that's a nice thing to be able to do.
Yes, so we're not sure on the release specifically for that yet, but we're getting very close. Essentially, what we're doing is configuration auditing on those endpoints. We're in a position where we have a high level of privilege already in the customer's environment, which you need in order to do configuration auditing. And the idea is you throw like a ASD, you know, hardening guide, let's say the Windows 10 1909, and then it will return back to you, well, this is how compliant you are with the guide. But the, I guess the differentiator for us is we're developing that feature for project managers so they can run it, get the results, and then drive down to the technical people in the business. You need to fix these particular things, and I will be running it next week. Not trying to make technical staff's lives harder.
Well, I think it helps the technical staff when the project managers have a document that they can not only beat the technical people over the head with, but they can take that upstairs as well, right? Like it's good to have that.
Exactly right. And consultancies, like so many companies get consultancies in to do this, and they'll do a point in time, okay, this is how compliant you are, and then they'll never return. You
know, and they're going to eat a pretty big bill on that too.
100%. Yeah. And it will be a sampled approach, you know, to a certain percentage.
Are you
going to
start throwing the word continuous at me like every other security company these days?
continuous monitoring.
Continuous config auditing.
Oh, and, that's it. Yeah.
Now, look, okay, so that one's not in this current release, but one thing that is, and this is another thing that I think people are going to be pretty interested in, is you can now restrict users. You can restrict like categories of execution to different users. So like if you want to block a whole bunch of users from being able to run PowerShell, you can.
Yeah, exactly. It was massively requested from our customer base to say,
I can see why. It's a really sensible feature.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess part of the challenge with, let's say, restricting PowerShell is you still want the administrators and SCCM and all that type of stuff to be able to administer the environment, right?
And, yeah, and previously you were doing like allow listing based on individual chunks of PowerShell, right? Individual scripts. Whereas now you're doing it by user, and it just like it makes so much more sense.
Well, you can do both.
Yeah.
You know, you can also restrict that and
but if you, but
restrict
if you have to
user.
Pick one, you're probably going to pick it by user, aren't you?
Yeah, true. You know, it's so much simpler and quicker to deploy in that type of scenario where you can just say this user group is done. I mean, one thing that I've always struggled with, you know, just in security operations work is Windows doesn't have a way that you can stop the PowerShell interpreter from loading. Even in group policy, you can block command prompt for standard users, but not PowerShell. And everyone just loads PowerShell and goes, okay, I'll just do what I need to do here. so, you know, the ability to do that is pretty big for us. And, you know, we're looking at taking that further with more complex rule sets as we mature.
It's funny, right? I describe you guys as the artisanal sourdough EDR, basically, and that's a very artisanal sourdough EDR type of
yes.
type of feature. Now, one thing that we were just discussing earlier is that the old argument of detection versus prevention is still frustratingly something that you get a bit of pushback on. And I don't quite understand this. Well, people say, you're blocking this stuff, you know, so you're not detecting it? Like, why? You don't need to detect it if you've blocked it, is kind of where I fall on that. But is this something that still you get, you experience?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, we always say prevention is detection by its nature, right? Like, if you prevent the thing in the first place, you don't need to worry about all these other classes. But I think we get pushback from a lot of people that say, well, if I do this obscure side technique over there, then I can potentially get to the point where I can execute this thing and therefore I need detection way down this chain. And then I think what the problem is that they then lose sight of, well, let's fix 99% of this risk up here and then we can worry about those, you know.
Is it one of those sort of bad faith arguments where they say, well, if I can get into a position to disable your agent, you can't stop it and therefore it won't get detected? Well, is it sort of like that, you know?
I can hack anything, nothing's secure, you know. Yeah. And it's you can go round and round in circles on that.
Every meeting's got one.
Exactly. And it's like a lot of our customers use that sort of attack simulation type software, which is really, really cool tech. But what they have to do in order to allow the attacks to run in the first place is essentially go through and trust every single file that's needed to execute the attacks in the first place in order to allow the attacks to run.
That's an interesting idea that in attack sim scenarios, you know, the allow listing approach might be at a disadvantage because the attack, you have to disable the protection. It's hurting my head, yeah. But I can see how it would kind of complicate things from an attack simulation point of view.
Yeah, it's like it's this catch 22, you know, in order to test.
But it is that whole, it is actually that joke that I made before, which is, you know, if they disable your agent, they can bypass your agent.
Yeah, exactly right. So, you know, we have those types of conversations all the time, and we always try and bring it back up a level and go, okay, let's, you know, you allow arbitrary code execution right now across your environment, yet you're worried about MITRE technique, you know, X all the way down the chain.
Yeah. So, well, you're always going to create a scenario. You're always going to be able to find a scenario, right? Where
exactly?
Yeah. No, I'm with you. But I mean, is there any plan to introduce some rudimentary, you know, endpoint monitoring into your product? I mean, the whole point of it is that you don't need it, right?
Well, yeah, and I guess we do get a lot of monitoring on files. So we build up a great file database, which is really, really rich and has a lot of value, you know, and we're definitely going to expand into getting things like call trees. But again, we've got the problem where you don't really even have a call tree if you stop the execution in the first place. So the telemetry is sort of...
Yeah, you've got nothing. You've got no corpus that you can run machine learning against to see all of this badness when you're stopping all the badness.
And as you mentioned before this call, it's like it's hard to talk about application control and blocking files because it just stops things so early on that there's not a lot of other avenues to sort of explore. Mm. I may have paraphrased you pretty heavily there, but
no, look, it makes a lot of sense, and I've seen other companies run into similar. And it's, look, let's face it, it's mostly just a marketing challenge. But like, I've done a bit of work with Vitero, and they're the guys who do they're the company that does content disarm and reconstruction, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, that's what they do. They pull down a file, they throw away anything that's non-compliant, they stick it back together, and you know, good luck sailing through that. But the problem is, you know, companies will say, oh well, you know, how do we know that it's actually stopped anything? How do we know we were attacked? And you know, for them, they can, as a marketing exercise, they can take files that went through a customer's instance that are 3 months old and then run them through against a contemporary AV scan and see what's, you know, been discovered as malicious in the meantime. And that's something they do. But I mean, it's a pointless exercise. It's purely just to make people feel good.
It's a huge amount of time. Like, we will, you know, we have some good relationships with a lot of different red teamers, and they will send a lot of code through saying, you know, does X, Y, or Z AV detect this? And, you know, all they'll do is spend all day, hours just changing strings in their file until it works. Mm. And it's like, well, if you just stop everything in the first place, isn't this a pointless exercise? And, but one thing we have seen is we've seen a lot of attackers move away a little bit from actually even assembly reflection or loading C# code in PowerShell right now to straight up DLL loading. The reason being is because, you know, EDR and detecting those behaviors is getting better, putting more eyes on, putting more visibility, and attackers are going back to those fundamentals. You know, loading a DLL on a system isn't unusual behavior. And if you can obfuscate your code so it's not detected by traditional AV and just load it straight into memory, then, you know, you win in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
You know, I think everyone
ran. And now is a good point, good time to point out that Airlock Digital, of course, it does allow you to, unless you allow list a DLL, you can't load it, right?
Yes, convenient.
it's almost like you're doing some marketing right now.
Yeah.
All right, David Cottingham, people can go check out version 4.6 of Airlock Digital, and they can use that to do all of their allow listing, of course, and already they can use it to do some host hardening, and very soon they'll be able to do their sort of policy audits with it as well. It's been great watching you continue to develop this product. I think it's really cool, and yeah, it's always great to speak to you, mate. I'll catch you again soon.
Thank you so much, Patrick. Really appreciate it.
That was Airlock Digital's David Cottingham there with this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to him for that. And you can check them out, of course, at airlockdigital.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.